It's good to see you all, and it's good to see some people who were here yesterday evening and some fresh faces for this morning. Our plan for this weekend is to investigate the stories we find in the Bible so that we can understand a little bit more about how they work. And if we can understand how these Bible stories work, we're more likely to see things we've never seen before, and also more likely to remember them as well. And a well-remembered Bible story, I'm sure if we think, what Bible stories are buried in our minds that we've carried with us over the years, a well-remembered Bible story is a precious gift. At a particular time in our lives, our minds go to a Bible story and we enter that story, and it buoys our spirits and brings us closer to God. So that's the aim of what we're going to continue to do this morning. Last night, we took a first look at some of the basics of Bible stories, and I'm going to just recap what we did last night briefly before we move on to something new this morning. We looked at what we find in Bible stories that are common in Bible stories. We looked at the fact that the way in which we think of modern stories, modern Western stories, emphasize details that Bible stories do not, and vice versa. So we can't make the mistake of reading a Bible story as if it were written here in Crieff, yesterday. It was that these Bible stories were originally written in a different language, in a different culture, and using different conventions. So what is usual about Bible stories? Just a quick review from last night. We can ask the question when we read it, what do characters say and what do characters do? And that seems a fairly basic thing to keep our eye on. What do characters say and what do characters do? Until we realize that that is essentially all that the Bible story gives us. It tells us what a character says and it tells us what a character does, but rarely does it tell us what's going on in the person's mind. What are their motivations? Is this act right or is it wrong? All of that is left to us to work out. Why? Because Bible stories are God's way of enabling us to grow in wisdom. And we grow in wisdom when we ourselves make moral decisions about characters in Bible stories. Because although sometimes the Bible will tell us, now Ahab was the worst king that Israel ever had. Now, when we hear that, we don't say, my word, that's a little bit ambiguous, isn't it? No. In that particular case, the biblical story wants to get, just in case you miss the fact, get this. But most of the time, it doesn't do it. So take great note of what characters say, what characters do, and from that, we will then construct what kind of a person they are. Is anything repeated? One of the great characteristics of Bible stories is the use of repetition. I took you through Daniel chapter 3 last night, remember? And I'm sure that may have been the source of some spiritual reflection for you as you awoke this morning, that repetition. But repetition serves a purpose, usually emphasizing what is of greatest significance. Is there a pattern of repetition? Do we get ABC, 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 and then that pattern is broken? It's often the element in a Bible story that breaks the pattern of repetition that is the most significant. And then you can check your footnotes in your English Bibles. Often a good Bible will give you a footnote and it will point out plays on words. We looked yesterday at the name for a man is Avam, and the word for ground is Adamah. So the man was taken from the ground. Avam was taken from the avama. You see, there's a play on words. And that isn't an attempt at humour, you know. When we hear that, we don't slap our thighs and say, hey, tell us another one, that was good. No, it's emphasising a very important point through a play on words. And you can pick that up in footnotes of your English Bible, and also words that have multiple meanings. And what is unusual? If we have something unusual, something you don't normally get in a Bible story, is there any physical description? Because if there is any physical description, and this I'm relying on those of you who were here last night, if there is physical description in a Bible story, how important is it? It is always. Can I hear that again? Always important. It's never a detail thrown into the story because the writer just wants us to know what somebody looks like. It's always significant for the story. And also, are we told what characters think or what characters know? Usually we're not, but if we are told what somebody is thinking or what somebody knows, how significant is that? It is always, always significant. So, as a summary from what we did last night. Now, the aspect of Bible stories I would like us to look at now is the way in which Bible stories are often put together. That is, for want of another term, the structure of Bible stories. What are the building blocks and how are they put together? So I'm going to start with one particular way in which Bible stories are put together. And if we can recognize these kinds of stories when we see them, I believe our eyes will be opened. I sound a bit like the serpent now, don't I? Your eyes will be opened and you will see God. Not quite. But our eyes will be opened and we'll see greater significance in the story that we're reading. So the first kind of story that I want to look at are what are called sandwich stories. Now, this may seem a little bit strange, and I'm not talking about a potluck here or the feeding of the 5,000, okay? Not sandwich stories. But by sandwich stories, this is what we mean. We start reading a story in the Bible, okay? That's story A. So story A starts. And then a little way into story A, story B turns up and interrupts story A. And story B runs its full course and ends, and then story A resumes. This is a sandwich story, okay? Story A here, story A there, that's the bread. And story B is it's the Marmite in between the two slices of bread, okay? A sandwich story. Let me give you an example. And I'm going to take a little time to read this story from the Bible. And then we'll have a look at, well, once you've seen that it's a sandwich story, so what? What does it do for you once you've seen it? This story comes from Mark chapter 5. It begins in verse 21. I think most of the stories we looked at last night, or all of them, were from the Old Testament. Wasn't that right? Here's one from the New Testament. You find sandwich stories throughout the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament, but Mark, in his gospel, has a particular liking for sandwich stories. So here's story A. We're going to read through it, and then we'll look at how the various parts of the story belong together. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue, named Jairus, came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So he went with him. He's off to see Jairus' daughter. This is story A. But then story B interrupts, beginning in the second part of verse 24. And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now, there was a woman who'd been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus and came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you? How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him, and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." So there's story B. Story B follows its full course, right? Self-contained story. Then story A resumes. Jairus' daughter. While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. And when he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which is Aramaic, Jesus' own language, Aramaic. "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was about 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this and told them to give her something to eat. End of story A. So a sandwich story, right? Story A begins, Jairus comes to Jesus. Story B interrupts, it's the woman with the hemorrhages. Her issue is solved. And then story A resumes. We're back with Jairus and his daughter. Now, let's look at how the various parts of that story relate to one another. Because in sandwich stories, if you're reading along and you identify a sandwich story, what's often good is then to ask, how do the various parts of the story relate to one another? Are these two independent, isolated stories, or does one story pass a comment on the other story? Let's see how it works in this one. So I've got three columns here. So story A, okay, this is where story A begins. Well, in that story, Jairus shows faith in Christ's power, doesn't he? He comes to Jesus and asks him to come and see his daughter. And then, I just realized that My computer's running on battery, and I just noticed it's sort of dimmed. But I forgot to put it in. Okay, sorry.
Give me life.
So, questions asked to the crowd. Jesus says in verse 30, "Who touched my clothes?" So Jesus is asking a question of the crowd. But in the story with Jairus' daughter, questions are asked by the crowd. Why trouble the teacher any further, they say. Your daughter's dead. And then, in the story of the woman with the hemorrhage, the disciples question Christ's statement. "Who touched you? You're surrounded by hundreds of people jostling, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" What are you talking about? And in the story of Jairus' daughter, the people questioned Christ's statement. He says, don't worry, she's not dead, only sleeping. Only sleeping? They laugh at him. So you see, you have two stories, a sandwich story, but there are many similarities between these two stories. So when you are studying this, don't treat the woman, you say, I'm going to, I don't know if you're going to preach or you're going to teach something, you say, I'm only going to talk about Jairus' daughter, this woman, you know, she sort of comes in and messes the story up, so we'll forget about her. Well, I'm just going to deal with Jairus' daughter. Mark says, I don't want you to do that. I want you to read the story of these two together, and I've given you a sandwich for you to savour, as it were, the similarities between these two stories.
Now, does that mean that the biblical writer may not have, the events may not have happened exactly that way, and in fact, maybe even the 12s weren't, maybe wasn't.
That's right. The interesting thing is, you see, here with Mark, he's arranged it as a sandwich story. You get these stories in some of the other Gospels, but they're not arranged as a sandwich story. They're separated. So Mark is creatively bringing these to ensure that we see the connection between the two. Now, here is another passage. This happens to be from Mark's Gospel again, and I'm going to ask you to analyze this as a sandwich, all right? So I'm going to read it so you can get a feel for it, and then I'm going to ask you, do you see a sandwich story here? Where do you see it? It was 2 days before the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread. The chief priests and the scribes were looking for a way to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him, for they said, not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people. While he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at the table, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment of nard, and she broke open the jar and poured the ointment on his head. But some were there who said to one another in anger, why was the ointment wasted in this way? For this ointment could have been sold for more, and 300 denarii, money given to the poor. And they scolded her. But Jesus said, let her alone. Why do you trouble her? She's performed a good service for me. For you always have the poor with you, and you can show kindness to them whenever you wish. But you'll not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for its burial. Truly, I tell you, wherever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her. Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. When they heard it, they were greatly pleased and promised to give him money. So he began to look for an opportunity to betray him. So that's the story. Now, can you see here any sandwich, A, B, A structure? Some of you are nodding your head. So where would you put... Story A begins. How much space does it take up? Well, obviously, story A begins here. Where does the first part of story A end? At the end of verse 2. Yeah. That's the beginning of story A. What about story B then? Well, that obviously begins here in verse 3. How far does that go? To the end of verse 9 here, right? Just before verse 10, yeah. So A, B, so A begins, B interrupts, and then here, A recommences and finishes. Now, what does it do for you when you see that you have a sandwich story here? So this is A, sorry, this is A, right, 1 to 2. This is... A continued, 10 and 11, and in the middle is B. Do you see any points of contact between between the bread and the Marmite, if I can put it that, you understand what I mean, right? Do you see any points of contact between the bread and the Marmite in this sandwich?
But Pastor Rod, is involved in both.
Yes, that's right. So in B, sold for more than 300 denarii, right? A sum of money. That's in story B. And down here, they promise to give him money. So that's the point of contact. Good, yes. Anything else? Yeah?
There's a repetition of the words looking for a way.
So where do we have that? It's just looking for a way here.
Rest, looking for a way, an opportunity to be right.
Is that down here? So that this is in verse, looking for a way to arrest. That's in verse 1. Where's the other looking for a way, sorry?
The last sentence.
Oh, looking for an opportunity to betray him. Yeah, that's right. The reason I was looking for it is that when I hadn't picked that up when I'd looked at it, so well done, yeah. So that's another repetition of phraseology, which bring those two together, yes. Anything else? Yeah. Well, that's right. That's quite right. That's a very good point. Because in story A at the beginning and story A at the end, we have people definitely opposed to Christ, right? And in the middle, we have this woman who's devoted to Christ. So it's not just a similarity. That's a very important contrast between the story A and story B. Yeah.
In section A, we're talking about the Jews trying to kill Jesus.
Yes.
In B, we've got the lady who's anointing his body, ready for his burial.
Exactly, yes, that's right. Okay, so they want to kill, in the beginning of story A, they want to kill Jesus here. And Jesus says, she's anointed my body beforehand for its burial. So that's another clear point of contact in story A, story B. There's a point at the back, yeah?
The first and the end of the story A, they're done in secret. It's secret at the top, secret at the bottom. But the one in the middle is very open. It's very public.
Yeah, exactly. That's another good point. So we've got, they need to do it by stealth, so it's all secret. You know, it's all handshakes at crossroads and all sorts of things there, beginning of the end. But in the middle, it's open, witnesses, people observing what's going on. So that's another clear contrast, and another way in which these stories are brought together through contrast. Yeah. The enemies are working in the shadows. Jesus is working in full public. Yeah. Is there anything else? There might well be. I'm just wondering. I wrote a few other ones down here. Maybe let's just look at one more before we move on. You notice this is another contrast. Notice that here we have anger. We have anger that this woman has wasted this money. But down here, they are greatly pleased and promise to give him money. So in story B, very angry over this waste of money, but very pleased that we can now give money to Judas to betray Christ. Was there one more?
The chief priests and the scribes, yeah, as well as the woman, are known throughout history. Jesus says that the woman, what she has done, will be known to all the world forevermore. But the world also knows what the chief priests, scribes, and Jesus did.
That's right, yes. So here we are, you know, so wherever the good news is proclaimed in the whole world, okay? Even in Crieff, in 2018, right, this story is going to be told. And lo and behold, it is, right? But not just that, but the chief priest. And notice also, you got the chief priests in the beginning of story A, and of course you have the chief priests in the continuation of story A. Now, I would claim that when you see that this is a sandwich story, and when you do make those comparisons, that our appreciation for Mark 4:1-11 is enhanced, is enriched. I mean, that's how I don't know, do you feel that? It's not just one story followed by another story, but it's the interrelationships between those stories that help us make connections. And then we've got an enriched understanding of the chief priests and of Jesus and of Judas and of the action that takes place. Mark's gospel is apparently simple, you know? I don't know if you've ever read Mark's gospel from beginning to end, apparently simple, but the more you look at it, the more complex, the more subtle it is. So, that is a sandwich story. There's another way in which Bible stories often structure themselves, put themselves together, particularly this time in the Old Testament. One of these is what's called panel writing. Now, what is panel writing? Well, we're going to illustrate it from Genesis 7, 6 to 16. And it's one of those details in the story which with our modern Western minds we'll frequently skip over. Let me read the first part of this. So, Genesis 7, verse 6. Noah was 600 years old when the flood of waters came on the earth. And Noah with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Of clean animals and of animals that were not clean, and of birds and of everything that creeps on the ground, two and two, male and female, went into the ark with Noah as God had commanded Noah. All right? Now, this is what we read in that. There's a date in Noah's life. It's followed with the flood comes. Noah and his family enter. The animals enter in pairs as God commanded. Then come to verse 11, back in Genesis 7. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened. The rain fell on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. On the very same day, Noah, with his sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons entered the ark. They and every wild animal of every kind, and all domestic animals of every kind, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, and every bird of every kind, every bird, every winged creature, they went into the ark with Noah, two and two of all flesh, in which there was the breath of life. And those that entered, male and female of all flesh, went in, as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. So, how does it continue? Well, it continues with a date in Noah's life, and the flood comes. Now, those two in this section are sort of interleaved a little bit, as you look at it, but it starts in that similar way. Then, Noah and his family enter, and the animals enter, in pairs, as God commanded. Now, we looked last night at repetition, but you see, what you have here is a particular kind of repetition. It's not just something you see here and something you see there, but you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 actually, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and you quite often will find this in passages where you get the same sequence, followed by exactly the same sequence, and then followed by exactly the same sequence. And why is it done? Well, it's a form of repetition, as we saw last night, and it's to emphasize. So, what does this emphasize? Well, this emphasizes, I'd suggest, the obedience of Noah. All right? Noah and his family enter. Noah and his family enter. It shows the obedience of creation. The animals enter. The animals enter. And it underlines the sovereignty of God. As God commanded, as God commanded. And there are some sections, you know, where you can get 4, 5, 6 panels, one after the other, which if we're reading, we might not pick up. But when you analyze what is there that's in common in each section, then it's obvious. A good example, I think, of panel writing is in Genesis chapter 1. And God said, let there be, And it was so, and God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning, a first day. And God said, let there be, and it was so, and God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning, a second day, and so on, all the way through the week. You're all familiar with that repetition? That's kind of panel writing. So it's not the occasional repetition here and the occasional repetition there. It's where a story is put together with multiple repetitions in the same sequence. And it's done for a purpose. In the creation account, I think one of the main reasons it's done in the creation account is to underline that with God, creation is effortless. God simply speaks. And God said, let there be, and it was so. And if you didn't get it the first time, let me give it to you the second time. And God said, let there be, and it was so. God saw that it was good. There was evening, and there was morning. Then, finally, the final kind of way in which Bible stories will construct themselves, well, they don't construct themselves, somebody else constructs them, of course, puts them together, are what are called chiasms. Now, I think maybe some of you have seen a chiasm before, and these occur in various ways, not just in stories as a whole. Often, even in a sentence in the Bible, a sentence will be structured as a chiasm in order to make it memorable and understandable. What is a chiasm? Well, a chiasm is a statement, a story, in which the second half of the story is the mirror image of the first half of the story. Now, let's begin with a simple one. This is just a sentence, okay? But this is a chiasm. Jesus says in Matthew 19, verse 30, many who are first will be last, and the last will be first. You see that the second half is the mirror image of the first half. This is just at the level of a sentence, all right? And then, of course, he also said, Mark chapter 2, the Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath. The second half of that statement is the mirror image of the first half of the statement. It makes it memorable, easy to remember and to repeat. Now, that's just at the level of a sentence, which is not really what we're interested in so much. We're interested in stories. So, let's have a look at a much larger chiasm. And I'm picking up on the biblical tradition of repetition, because those of you who were here 2 years ago, I think it was just over 2 years ago, I was here in Crieff, and we did a weekend on Genesis. So I'm going to repeat something that I did then. This is, you know, good biblical tradition here, all right? I'm going to repeat. But it's a good example on a large scale, and we're going to look at how the flood story is put together. Now, we've got about 10 minutes, so let me take you through this briefly, okay? The structure of the flood story. We begin, this is chapter 6, verses 9 to 10. If we start the story there for now, we are told that Noah has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And then the story moves on, and we're told that there is violence in God's creation. God looks at his creation and he sees that it is full of violence. You can follow along in your Bible just to keep me honest, okay? Make sure that there's no skullduggery here. Then we move on and God makes a resolution to destroy. Because the earth is filled with violence and injustice, God will destroy his creation. And that takes up chapter 6, verses 13 to 22. It's a longer section. Then there is a command to enter the ark, beginning of chapter 7. God says to Noah, enter the ark, you and all your family and all the animals with you. And that's told in a bit of detail, chapter 7, verses 1 to 10. And then we get the beginning of the flood, chapter 7, 11 to 16. The waters begin to fall, the fountains of the deep burst forth. And then we get the rising floodwaters. So we're told that the floodwaters rise and rise and rise until they're at their highest point, so many cubits over the highest mountain. And then we come to the statement which is in the center of this chiasm. At the beginning of Genesis 8, verse 1, it says, "And God remembered Noah." Now, when the Bible says God remembered Noah, obviously it doesn't mean to say until that point he'd forgotten all about him, you know, woke up and said, "Oh, dear. Better do something." As you're probably aware, in the Bible, the verb to remember, the word to remember, is a verb of salvation. So the Lord remembered Israel, and he called them out of Egypt. God remembered Hannah, and she conceived and bore a child. So this is the sense of the verb to remember. And that statement, that God remembers Noah, stands in the middle of this chiasm of the flood. And now, from that point on, the rest of the story is the mirror image of the beginning of the story through comparisons and contrast. So what happens next? Well, the receding floodwaters. The floodwaters begin to recede, go down, and then we get the drying of the earth. This is the section where Noah sends out birds from the ark. Why does he send out birds from the ark? Well, to discover whether the ground is dry enough for them to disembark. So that's the drying of the earth. Then there comes God's command to leave the ark, come out of the ark, you and your family and all the animals with you. Then God gives a resolution to preserve. As long as there will be the seasons, as long as winter... I've forgotten how it goes now, sorry. Seed time and harvest and so on will continue without end. So God makes a resolution to preserve the earth. And then there's covenant blessing and peace. This is the section where we have the rainbow. The rainbow is the sign of a covenant that God will never again destroy the earth by water as he has just done in the flood. And then we conclude by being told that Noah and his three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So you see, we get Noah and his sons at the beginning, Noah and his sons at the end. Violence in God's creation here is contrasted with blessing and peace here. The resolution to destroy with a resolution to preserve and so on. So the whole account is a balanced chiasm and it centers on this. That is to say, dear reader, what is the central point of the flood story? The central point of the flood story is this: God remembered Noah. So the flood story is indeed a story of judgment, but at its heart is an act of God's salvation, because God remembered Noah. Now, we can say that about the flood. However, we can expand it, okay? Because the flood story, I believe, is actually larger than this. And let's see how we can expand it and what we can then learn from seeing the structure of the flood story. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add two extra elements. Are you with me here? You thought that was maybe complex enough, but two extra elements at the beginning, two extra elements at the end. And if you look at Genesis 5, verse 32, this is the beginning of Noah's genealogy in Genesis 5. Genesis 5 has given us several generations. Noah is the 10th. 5:32 says, "After Noah was 500 years old, Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth." If you compare that to the other genealogies in chapter 5, you'll notice that Noah's genealogy is just cut off in the middle. So then what comes next? is there's an offence, there's a sin of some kind. This is the section dealing with the sons of God and daughters of men. All right? I think I mentioned this last time I was here. If you think you have the answer as to who the sons of God and daughters of men are, see me, because I'd like to hear what you have to say. But what it's an obscure passage, but whatever it means, there is an offence which occurs there. Then we get the rest of that chiasm. We just looked at that, okay? Don't try to read it, you'll ruin your eyesight. But that's that chiasm that we just looked at. And then we're going to add, so we've got two extra ones at the top, and now we're going to add two extra elements at the bottom here. Straight after that, there's another offence. This is when Noah becomes drunk and Ham sees the nakedness of his father. Another obscure passage. And then, would you believe it? After all that, we get the rest of Noah's genealogy. What was missing at the top in 928? After the flood, Noah lived for 350 years. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Just like all those other people mentioned in chapter 5. Okay? Now, what do we learn from this? Well, this is something that we could learn probably just from reading the story, but from looking at the structure of the story, I think this makes something fairly obvious, and that is, there is sin immediately before the flood. In fact, it's human sin that is the motivation for sending the flood. So there's human sin immediately before the flood. But what do we see immediately after the flood? There is sin immediately after the flood. So the sin immediately before it, and the sin immediately after it. In other words, we conclude that whatever the flood did, whatever the flood achieved, one thing it did not achieve was to solve the problem of human sin. Because you can't solve the problem of sin simply through punishment. There has to be another way. The flood punished sinners. Yes, so you can say it achieved that. But the people who emerge from the ark, no sooner are they out of the ark than they're sinning again. That is worth more than 2 minutes of our reflection when our brains are functioning at their height, okay? The structure, the chiasm, yes. At the very center, what do we have? The very center, God remembers Noah. The very center is salvation. And at the outside, the intractable problem of human sin. How is God's desire to save and our human capacity to sin, how is that going to be sorted out? Well, it's going to take a time, and it takes us all the way into the New Testament and beyond. But all of that, I'd suggest, is alluded to in the structure of the flood story. And with that, I need to conclude, because my time has gone. Except to say this. Summary of what we've done. When you're reading Bible stories, in addition to what we did last night, ask yourself, does this story have any obvious structure? Is it a sandwich story? Is there panel writing? Is there a chiasm? Don't force it if it isn't there, because I've met people who see chiasms. You know, the whole of The Great Controversy by Ellen White is all an enormous chiasm. You know, you have to persuade me on that. But if it is there, reflect on what it is saying. And frequently, if I just go back to the previous one, the central point of a chiasm you'll find at the hinge in the middle. We'll conclude there.